Hello, I'm Charles Mallett, and this is an interview for UK Column. There'll be notes and links below this interview at ukcolumn.org. Now, today I'm going to be speaking to Morgan Lorette, who served in the United States Air Force and Army, and most notably as a private military contractor in Iraq for Blackwater. Morgan has recently published a book called Guns, Girls and Greed about his experiences in Iraq some 20 years ago. I'm very, very pleased to have him on the programme today, and there's much to get through. But I think what we'll start with, Morgan, is for most people that the name Blackwater will bring up all sorts of connotations and thoughts effectively after the event. And so I suppose the question on a lot of people's lips might be, why on earth would you have wanted to join Blackwater in the first place?
Well, and that's a fair question. Thanks for having me on. When I joined Blackwater in 2004, it was well before all the negative connotations happened with Blackwater. So the one thing that did happen before was the contractors got hanged on the bridge in Fallujah in 2004. So it was equally as insane to join Blackwater because of that, as opposed to what happened later in 2007. But honestly, it's 23 years old. It was so much money. It was $550 a day. And you go over there and you get to go get your adventure, right? So it's the best of both worlds. You get paid and you get to have really cool stories that you can write a book about later.
Yeah, I mean, having read the book, which is fantastic, very, very candid insight into exactly what did go on, and indeed, you know, reporting the adventures of others as well, one does come away with an extraordinary insight into exactly what it is that did happen. But just with your perspective as it is now, just talk us through your, in effect, your voyage from the Air Force into, in effect, a sort of civilian yet military organization, and what that transition was like, not just for you, but the people around you.
Yeah, so it was really, I wish I could sit there and say that I had this grand life plan. I've just kind of fallen face first into one opportunity after another. So when I was in the Air Force, I met these former special operations guys, and they said, hey, we're all going to go work for Blackwater. And I was like, ooh, you guys have fun. Those guys just got hanged in Fallujah. You kind of know where that's going to go. And I was not going to go work for Blackwater at all. One, I was not special operations. I was not nearly as cool as I thought, you know, you needed to become a Blackwater operator. And two, it just seemed like there was way too much risk. It, like, the amount of money didn't really matter. But Blackwater was so young back in those days that they would literally bring people into Moyock, North Carolina, where they would train Blackwater people. And they'd say, who do you know that we can call? So that's how I got dragged into it, is my buddy went over there. He got into a training class and he said, hey, call Morgan. So 5 a.m., I got a call from a random number out in Virginia. And they said, hey, this is, you know, Tyler from Blackwater. You want to come join? And I was like, I'm tired. I don't have much else going on right now. So why the heck not? But a lot of people joined Blackwater because you have to look at the paradigm of combat before this. So unless you were in Somalia in 1993 or you were in Desert Storm in 1991, you had a lot of people that spent about 10 years in the military getting trained to do military stuff, right? You join the military, you want to go over there, blow stuff up, and you want to get combat, and then you don't. This gave individuals an opportunity who were special operations, rangers, you know, Navy SEALs, all those guys that had trained and trained and trained and got out of the military, never got to actually do what they trained for. And it gave them opportunity to go over there, make a crap ton of money, as well as like finally get the combat operations that they were hoping for. And that's kind of the story of the book, is it's a bunch of guys coming together with a job that nobody really knows how to do. It was a brand new type of security arrangement. And how do you get that done? And every day was just a learning experience. And it was also just an absolute melee.
You wrote specifically in the book about the contract that Blackwater had secured, which I think I'm right in saying was the Worldwide Personal Protective Service. And in effect, as I understand it, they secured the contract, but because of the effective sort of skill deficit, the manning or the staffing of that was going to be a problem. and you write about it, and indeed the sort of State Department security clearance. So you just talk us through that side of it, the sort of the recruitment and the clearance and the standards that needed to be met and how you perceived that.
Yeah, so in 2004, when Paul Bremer left Iraq, we essentially gave the state of Iraq over to the interim Iraqi government. The U.S. And all the coalition partners did not want to be seen as individuals that were occupiers, right? That was the big concern back in 2004. So as soon as it went to the Iraqi government, it became a diplomatic mission and not a combat mission in the eyes of almost all of the governments that were there. Now, the problem is that the State Department had a protective service, but it probably only had a handful of individuals that had actually done it. And they hadn't done it in an active combat zone. So that's where Blackwater jumped in. Blackwater had people that were already trained in combat operations, you know, shoot, move, communicate, be able to do all that cool combat stuff. And then you can go in and learn how to actually protect a diplomat the way that the State Department would train their own people. And after 2-3 weeks of that, be able to just go directly into a combat zone to start protecting these diplomats. And what the diplomats did, if you recall, we had like the big de-bathification. So all the military, all the government was all taken out of their positions of power because they were Ba'ath Party members under Saddam Hussein. And now you had to train the new Iraqi government how to run stuff, day-to-day operations, pick up garbage. How do you set up a stock market? How do you run an airport? They had a huge deficit. So the people that we protected were the ones that would go over and kind of train these people how to do stuff. And of course, you can't get from, you know, nice, comfortable, not going to get shot at point A to point B without having a bunch of knuckle draggers like me driving you around and making sure that you're going to make it there safely. So that's really where Blackwater got the contract. And then when they got the contract, there's only so many Navy SEALs that you can find, right, that have already gotten out. So people like me started getting random calls saying, hey, you did security forces, which is military police for the Air Force. Can you come over here? Can you pass the security clearance? Can you pass the weapons qualifications, the physical fitness test, all those things? And if you could do that, they would have you on a plane literally the next day going into Baghdad, Iraq. Yeah, it was insane.
So it sounds it, and I would urge everyone listening to read, you know, more about it in the book, because it is eye-watering. And I want to come back to a lot of that, specifically on the diplomats, the people that Blackwater had the contract for protecting. It might be difficult to make a general view, but what was your opinion of their capability and their work ethic and the success or otherwise that they were having whilst they were actually at the interface with the Iraqis?
Diplomats and military members are not cut of the same cloth for the most part. You know, that's a general thought. But a lot of the diplomats come from these really good schools, you know, the Harvards, the Tufts universities, all those fancy ones. And the way they see the world is just not the same way as somebody that has gone through a military paradigm. So military people, you go out there, you know, you engage the enemy, you make sure that you can complete your mission. Diplomats really want to lead with diplomacy, right? They want to lead with, hey, we can help you do this and you guys can do all these amazing things. So it was always like a headbutting between the two, where we would say, hey, we're going to get you to point A to point B safely. And then we end up smashing into a car. And that car flies off onto, you know, into another few vehicles, and the diplomat goes, well, why'd you do that? Why'd you have to do that? It's like, because we're trying to like save your life. We're trying to make sure that you're protected. So I think it's good to have government organizations that have these different ideas and these different paradigms to have a government working correctly. But injecting that much diplomacy into an active combat zone that early into combat was probably a net negative. And you could see it with the diplomats. You could see when we first got there, they always wanted to go out. They always wanted to go get out into the red zone, go help. We did the regime crime stuff for the trials for Saddam Hussein and Chemical Ali. Like, let's get out there. Let's get this evidence. Let's move it. And then as people started dying and they started realizing, you know, you're getting rockets raining down on you and there's a car bomb right outside of the green zone, they were a little less excited to go out when it was real life. So it was always just we worked on their schedule, but some days you would go out, run 3, 4, 5 times. And some days you would just sit around and do nothing for 2, 3, 4 days at a time.
Again, that comes across in the book. I'm going to quote back to you a section that you relate from your, well, the Welcome to Blackwater text, which states, "The risks include, among other things, and without limitations, the undersigned being shot, permanently maimed, and or killed by a firearm or munitions, falling from an aircraft or helicopter, sniper fire, landmine, artillery fire, rocket-propelled grenade, truck or car bomb, earthquake or other natural disaster, poisoning, civil uprising, terrorist activity, hand-to-hand combat or disease, etc., killed or maimed while passenger in a helicopter or other aircraft, suffering hearing loss, eye injury or loss, inhalation or contact with biological or chemical weapons, whether airborne or not, and or flying debris, etc." I don't know if you can remember precisely your emotions when you read that for the first time, but I think, you know, the audience would be fascinated for you to sort of go back in time and just describe in a way how much of that came to pass and how it affected you and all of those that you were with.
I mean, who wouldn't want to sign up for that? You read it so eloquently. It's interesting because looking back, that is the business part of private security that you're reading, right? You sign a contract and they give you all these things that are like, you can't hold us liable if, you know, your leg gets chopped off. A lot of that stuff came to pass, not for me particularly, but you can read about it in the book, where we had 9 contractors die in April 2004. And these are your friends. Like, these are the people that we would drink beer with, eat lunch with on a daily basis. There were a number of people that were injured. Like, we were out there next to the burn pits. You know, that's all the rage now. You're sitting there just soaking in all those toxins that they were burning. Almost all of that stuff actually came true for people within Blackwater at one point or the other. Now, the irony of it is you sign this contract, and when you get home, there is no VA. There's no department that goes and helps contractors. So you put yourself in the exact same harm's way, and people say, yeah, well, you made a lot more money than the soldiers. And they're right. So we did it willingly. But when you look at all those things that happen and the effects that they have long term, there is no support system for contractors. And what you're seeing now is the contractor paradigm has not shrunk very much. They've just figured out different ways to do it, right? There's contractors in Syria. They're in the Ukraine. They're over in Israel. Anywhere where there's a hotspot, there's private military contractors that are over there training the local forces. So we also have them at the U.S.-Mexico border, which I don't know how much your listeners are familiar with, but there's just a huge influx of migrants coming through the border. And instead of having government agencies, they are sending private military contractors down there to do some of that work. So when you get done contracting, it's just you. It's just you and your thoughts. So all those same thoughts you have as a soldier that goes overseas, you come home and you don't come back with your buddies. It's just you. And you're seeing the high suicide rates among contractors. PTSD rates are like just astronomical for contractors because they're over there year after year after year because that's how they make their living. And then come home and nobody cares. They say, oh, well, you were just a contractor. So it's a very weird space to be. If I could go back when I was signing that contract and look at somebody and say, you're signing this contract, the first thing I would tell them is, don't do it. Absolutely don't do it.
Really? Wow. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of that. I was sort of, you know, going to come on to, and in particular, like you say, the sort of support, the after service support, as it were. I mean, in the United Kingdom, there's still a very strong feeling that that even armed forces veterans are not being looked after correctly. And exactly the period that you identify, that time, which was in effect a quiet period of just training and people just wanted to get into the thick of it. But obviously, as you describe, on the private side, absolutely no sort of care given to those afterwards. Is that something that you've seen change at all over the intervening 20 years? Is there any sort of program that people, that private military contractors are offered in terms of sort of decompression or risk management, trauma management, any of that?
I mean, thankfully, there's a Facebook page where you can go on and you can complain, but that's about it. I make a joke about it, but that really is the support system, is a bunch of guys on Facebook. And if somebody says I'm having a bad day, then they can go in and say, hey, give me a call or something along those lines. But there is no support system. Now, thankfully, a lot of us were prior service. There are VA resources for those that were prior service, but if you can't tie that back to your time in the service, the VA is not going to take care of you for your time when you were over there as a contractor. So it hasn't gotten any better by any stretch of the imagination. And people that have left contracting are still having a hard time, right? You don't have your paycheck that's coming in. You don't have like your friends that are around. You don't have anybody to really talk to. And let's be honest, the cost of going and talking to a therapist or something is pretty steep. And a lot of these people are like stubborn, like me. Oh, I can figure it out. I figured out all this other stuff. I've been in worse situations. And then until the point that it reaches a crescendo, they can't figure it out and something bad ultimately happens.
Yeah. And I think that, well, I mean, certainly that comes across strongly sort of in the latter parts of your book. Just to go back a bit and talk about the times that people obviously did form very close relationships on the ground, in your case, in Iraq. Talk to me about the green zone and the sort of phenomenon of its existence and what went on within that environment and all the different operators within that place, and indeed the way that people were able to conduct themselves, which I think will be probably quite surprising. You might want to spare some of the details, but just an overall, you know, view of the green zone and exactly what role it played in you know, the whole piece for you, for Blackwater, and for all the other agencies involved.
Yeah, so the green zone was really the nucleus of U.S. operations in Iraq, and it was supposed to be this utopian society where the Iraqis and the U.S. forces all lived together. We had the big embassy, which was Saddam's palace, had a beautiful pool behind it. That's where a lot of shenanigans went on. But it was ill thought out because it wasn't a big green zone. It wasn't this big, you know, mishmash. It was like all these different compounds within it. All of them were walled off. And even if you went into the embassy, you would see that, right? You have the CIA over here. Other intelligence agencies, the Department of Defense, they would all kind of wall themselves off. And then you had the local population that was moving in and out of the green zone on a regular basis. So I think it was within like the first 2 months I was there, they had moved enough bombs into the green zone to blow up one of the local markets. So they blew up a market. They blew up one of the local restaurants where the diplomats would go and hang out to do some of their meetings. So there was no way of keeping things separated. But the green zone was also where you could party. You could get alcohol. You could get steroids. You could get they had a nightclub underneath the hotel where you could go and you could hang out at this nightclub and dance around like you were just a normal human in a normal place. So it was a very, if you could take all the crazy things from college and put them all together, right? You have your people that are really, really focused on studying, and then you have your people that are only there to party, and then you have your in-between. That was the green zone with, you know, frat parties on one side, and then on the other side, people that are trying to create policies to move Iraq forward as a sovereign country. And the movie Green Zone, I actually finally watched that thing. It was quite a bit more accurate than I thought, because if you didn't live it, you just have no idea. The best thing about the Green Zone, though, is the pool was right behind the embassy, and the chow hall where we ate everything was right there by the door. So you could sneak into the embassy after you've been drinking for 4 or 5 hours and steal all the Pop-Tarts on the way to your hooch so you could lay down. So positive for me. If you're waging a war, I would say it's probably not the best way to try to do it.
You know, what I was going to ask about was really the blurring of the lines between, I suppose, military, civilian, diplomatic, other agencies, intelligence agencies and whatnot, having in effect everybody there in one melting pot, obviously notwithstanding what you're saying about separate compounds, but was there that sense that that relationships between the different agencies were perhaps compromised because of that?
Yeah, we all hated each other. The military hated the private contractors because we'd get drunk at the pool and then they'd have to send the MPs out and be like, hey guys, time to go home. It's like, well, can you get a DUI over in Iraq? I don't even know. Should I drive my Suburban or should I walk home? But there was always like a fight of who was going to get the credit for what was going right. Nobody ever wanted the credit for what was going wrong. But you could see it at the pool where you're hanging out with all these different agencies and military people. And the military people did not like the agencies or the contractors because we didn't have to play by the rules. So military guy would come up and say, hey, you're not allowed to have a loaded weapon in here. And I'd be like, yeah, I can, because I have this fancy W on my badge, which meant that I could walk around with a loaded weapon. But nobody knew what the other one was doing. Even if you look at our operations, if we were driving to northern Baghdad to, you know, move evidence for Saddam Hussein's trial, we never told the army where we were going, when we were going, how we were going to get there, what routes we were taking. If you lost radio communication, there was no savior. It was just you and the 12 people and your diplomat. You just had to make sure that that person was alive at the end. So you couldn't go into Baghdad and not run into each other. And I hear these stories all the time from military members say, oh, I remember you guys, we shot at you. And I said, well, you guys are terrible aims because you guys didn't hit any of us. But it would happen all the time. We would just be driving and we'd come up on the back of a convoy, British convoy, an American convoy, another PMC convoy. And it was just havoc on the road because that's what you want to do. You want to control the road so that you can protect yourself as much as possible.
I think anybody with any experience of government departments or indeed military departments will know that infighting and being at loggerheads is very much par for the course. But were you aware of the system you described as being designed to work like that, as in there was a deliberate separation with no overlap or sort of shared communications network? Or is that just the way that people decided that they wanted to play it?
Oh, no, it was everybody was just making up their own rules. I mean, it goes all the way back to the invasion of the war. That was not terribly well designed. There was no after we do combat operations, what happens. So everybody just kind of grabbed their own little piece of land, put their own base on it and said, OK, I'm going to operate out of this. And the same thing happened when we gave over the government to Iraq, the Iraqi government is. Everybody was going to play by their own rules. Everybody was going to try to take credit for where they could. A lot of people in the military did not want to be there. I mean, why would you? Maybe the dysentery is really good. It beats taking Ozempic. But a lot of the agency people would volunteer to go over there. So for them, it was a career booster. For your, you know, E1, E2, your lower enlisted guys, it was just a slog. It was a year-long slog. You would see these people coming in and out for 3 months and they're talking about how great they're doing and how amazing it is. And you spread that out, you extend that runway to a year, and anybody that was on the ground could see that it was not going well. But every time you had the news on, they would talk about, oh, how great it's going and it's amazing. I remember I was on a phone call, and this is in the book. I'm talking to my aunt and there's this huge car bomb that blows up, like right outside the thing. And my aunt's like, oh, how's it going? Like I'm just hanging out over there doing the daily stuff, getting my milk and cereal and, you know, going out to the local, you know, Walmart. And it's like, it's fine. Cause what they were seeing back home just wasn't the case on the ground. And I think we did that for 20 years. We did the same thing in Afghanistan for 20 plus years. And you see how it turns out when you're sitting there lying to yourself and lying to the populace that's funding it for that long.
Yeah, I think we'll come back to the sort of distorted picture of reality that was broadcast back to certainly to into the West. You've spoken about the absence of rules and, you know, scant regard for laws and practices and that. Just talk me through from the Blackwater point of view, talk me through your training, but also specifically with regard to rules of engagement and how you were exposed to, or at least asked to treat the laws of armed conflict and that side of it?
The short answer is that there was no training on the rules of engagement, the laws of armed conflict. Now, a lot of us are prior military, prior police officers. Like, the morality compass still pointed north. We weren't going to go out there and just try to wreak havoc on everybody to do it. I'm not saying there weren't people that did, but I think you have that in the military, the same way you have it with contractors, same way that you have it with different agencies. So this is where it gets really, really gray. Whose jurisdiction do you fall under as a private military contract? So you're outside the wire, which means you're theoretically governed by the laws of Iraq because you're in Iraq, but you're not governed by the Uniform Code of Military Justice, the military legal system. Whose laws are you actually governed by? Like, you can't be governed by the state laws, you know, back in Arizona or Texas or wherever you're at. And I think that politicians have made a conscious decision to not define that. Because if you define it and something bad happens, it says, well, who was doing oversight on this? Who was the person or the agency that said, we did this contract, we made sure that they were trained to do X and they did Y, and that's on us and it's on that individual. So it was really just every day, if you had to do something that you didn't necessarily like, could you go and put your head on your pillow and say, hey, I did the right thing? Or could you not? And I wish I could say that they sat us down and told us that these are all the rules of engagement. But in 04, car bombs were all the rage. And you served. Every car over there is white with like orange doors on it. So you go and you get your intel brief and they say, hey, we have an intelligence assessment that says that there's a car bomb and it's in a car with white on the front and orange on the doors. That's every car in Baghdad. So what do you do when a car like that is screaming up on you? Do you engage that car? You have a very important person that's in the vehicle with you. It could be a U.S. senator. It could be the ambassador to Iraq. Like, how do you react to that? And there is no right answer. Because if you engage it, you could get in trouble. If you don't engage it, it could blow you up and kill everybody. So you just kind of figured out how you could get your pillow or your head on your pillow at night and sleep.
I think that's really well articulated. And that gives an insight into the incredibly difficult sort of second by second decision making process that people have to go through on the ground all the time. Just to sort of tease that out a bit further, did it come up as a talking point within Blackwater? And that's part of the question. The other thing is, you're just talking about intelligence, access to intelligence on which you could base these sorts of decisions. How did that work, especially being alongside military and other agencies?
So we did have access to like the big intelligence system over in the U.S. Embassy. So it was military, it was the agency stuff. And you could go in there and get like an intelligence summary, like what's happening, where are the bombs happening. You could do, if you're probably not familiar with it, but there's this big wheel and they put the days of the week and they put the months of the day and it'll say, hey, there's bombs that are going off here, here, and here. And these are the days that are doing it. So you can kind of see where there's patterns, but there was no regular intelligence thing that came to our email and said, hey, by the way, if you go down Haifa Street today, there were 17 Iranians that were moved into there and they're part of the Republican Guard. There was none of that. So it was really just us using that intel to decide how we were going to drive the roads and where we were going to drive without a whole lot of, you know, actual in-depth ideas of what was actually happening on the ground.
And just quickly, because I mean, you may not have necessarily a bearing on it, but I know after this phase of your life, you then went back, you went into the army and served in army intelligence. Did you ever deal with private military contractors in that job?
I mean, I dealt with private military contractors about as much as I dealt with the army when I was a private military contractor.
Okay.
So they would come into the base. And I would be like, what the heck are these guys doing in my area of operation? Like, why are they here? And I would go over there and talk to them. And they'd say, oh, yeah, I'm picking up a dog for this guy. And then I'm going to drive it over to. And it was the same thing in 09 and 10 when we were kind of winding down the war. And from an intelligence officer perspective, it was extremely frustrating because it's not that difficult. And it's both ways for the Army to reach out to the PMCs, and it's, or the PMCs to reach out to the military, but they don't really want to. Like, that's extra work. And you know what? I could use that time to go work out, or I can, you know, walk to the Pizza Inn or the Burger King if you're lucky enough to be right there. So yeah, it's frustrating on both sides, but neither side actually cares enough to try to bridge that gap.
Yeah, I think that will resonate with the military and ex-military audience that UK Column has. I mean, the constant refrain about learning the lessons and then absolutely refusing to learn them by passing them on, or indeed talking to anybody about them. Just going back to the bigger picture stuff, because you do write, particularly towards the end of the book, more about the rebuilding of Iraq, and clearly a very serious subject. Having had time to think about and reflect on it, from what you saw on the ground, do you think, if we sort of perhaps separate the issue of whether there was any need for anyone to be there in the first place, but the fact that it had happened and people were there, do you think there's a way in which things could have been done differently for a different or better outcome?
No. And the reason is that you have the Sunnis and the Shias and the Kurds all within a single state. None of these sectarian groups like each other. They never have. They never will. So the only way that we could have made it better is if we would not have interjected ourselves for as long as we did. So just kind of background, the Sunnis and the Shias have been fighting since Muhammad died on who could take over the Muslim religion. They are going to fight. Saddam Hussein was a Sunni, and he kept everybody in check. You know, iron fist, like horrible human, not giving him any credit, but he kept all that stuff in check. As soon as he was taken out of that equation, the Sunnis were like, we've got 30, 40 years of retribution that we want to get back. And it was going to happen. So that's when 03, 04, you had the kill squads going through Baghdad. You had all of the neighborhoods that were separating themselves into Sunnis versus Shias. You had the Kurds up north that essentially said, if you go north of Kirkuk, this is our country, don't come. And there's no way that you're going to be able to take thousands of years of fighting and arguing and come in there and give them a democracy. At some point, two kids are going to sit there at the playground, they're going to argue, and they're going to fight at the bike rack. That's what was going to happen. It didn't matter if we stayed there for 2 years or 200 years. It was always going to happen. And that's what you see right now. You see the Sunnis control the government. I'm sorry, the Shias control the government. The Sunnis are pissed off about it because they had control for so long. And then the Kurds just are trying to be up there saying, leave me alone. I have to fight Turkey because I want to create Kurdistan. So how do you change that much history over the course of 3 years and say, hey, democracy is good. You guys are really going to enjoy the heck out of this stuff. It's never going to happen.
And with that in mind, would I be right in thinking that sort of encapsulates your view on, let's say, US foreign policy all over the world?
Oh, 100%. We continue to get ourselves in places where it's not going to change the outcome. And if it's not going to change the outcome, then why the heck are we doing it? Why are we sacrificing, literal human beings, people that have families and loved ones? And that's on the US side, and it's on, you could say it with the Ukrainians, the Russians. These people have families and lives, and you are literally decimating an entire generation of that with that trauma. And the end is going to be the same anyway. It's not going to change. So I think when we look at diplomacy, we need to stop leading with PMCs, because right now we're not putting boots on the ground. It's not politically advantageous. So we lead with PMCs, and then it slowly gets built up and built up. Vietnam was the same way. We started over there with advisors, and then we built up and we built up and we built up. We're not learning from history. And I don't think anybody would look at Vietnam and say, wow, we really went in there and gave them the heck out of that democracy and they enjoyed it. So if we can't affect it, I think you just have to let those kids fight at the bike rack. And then afterwards, usually they shake hands and they're going to be okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a view that will resonate with the audience for sure. You write about this again towards the end, and you say US government agencies, including PMCs, must be held to strict standards and accountability in combat zones just as US military forces are, as their conduct reflects US foreign policy and national defense. I mean, that's a very cogent, sane statement. But do you think it's one that is ever going to get through in Washington or London or wherever else?
No, because it's too easy to send private security contractors over there right now. And it's everywhere. It's easier to send private security contractors down to the U.S.-Mexico border to move unaccompanied minors throughout the United States. It's easier to send them to Syria, because if you put boots on the ground and somebody dies or somebody gets hurt, it's going to be in the news cycle for 2, 3, 4 weeks. If you send a civilian over there that signed up for it and is making more money, there's a lot less sympathy for PMCs. So I would say 2.5 months ago, there was some PMCs that died in Syria. It made the news cycle for about 3 seconds. And then we had the U.S. troops in Jordan, where they had the drone attack that ended up killing, I think killed one and ended up hurting a number of the other ones. And that was in the news cycle for 3, 4, 5 weeks, because nobody knew that we had this base in Jordan anyway. So it's going to be so much easier just to create these bases with PMCs and kind of scatter military members among them. And if somebody gets hurt, I mean, I hate to, you know, think of this, but I think people up in Washington, D.C. are sitting there playing paper, rock, scissors. Like, if there's an attack, hopefully they just get a civilian instead of a military member, because it's not going to look good for us.
Yeah, absolutely. And talking about, again, about the sort of hierarchical nature of all these entities, something that struck me was the way in which you described people. I mean, you left intelligence as a captain, and you wrote, I would say, very damningly, but fairly accurately, obviously, about those of the rank of major or above, describing them as staff gods who contribute zero to the military. I think it'd be really interesting for the audience just to understand where that comes from and how it transfers, you know, across other spectrums, not just the military. I mean, was there a level in Blackwater above which you've considered that people could be described as such, or indeed you've seen it sort of outside in the civilian world?
Yeah, there's always that middle management piece that tries to be more important than they are, right? In the military, you're usually at the company grade or below, all right? So if you're a captain, you're going to be at the company level. You're probably going to be doing combat operations. Once you make major, you're not doing any of that stuff. What you are doing is you're going around and you're nitpicking people on how they're doing stuff. Anybody that's spent time in the military and has dealt with like vehicle inspections, and there's this overweight, you know, major that comes out there and says, oh, your steering wheel was tilted a little to the right, it needs to be in the middle. You're not adding any value to anybody's life, especially in combat operations. And that's where a lot of the majors kind of found themselves, as they were in this middle management rung where they didn't have, like, they weren't cool guys, they weren't on the ground doing stuff, and they weren't decision makers. So they just hung out there in that purgatory, that misery. I kind of feel bad for them, but not really, because I didn't like any of them. But you see that in corporate America. You see it in the different agencies. Blackwater did not have it as much, because that's the whole point of Blackwater, is we can do it a lot more efficient. We can do it for cheaper. We can do it with a lot less people. So there was much less middle management. However, there's still that distance in between the people on the ground and the people that run the company or run the operations or say, this is my strategy. Eric Prince will sit there and go on podcasts all day and talk about how great we were, the amazing things that Blackwater did. He just wasn't on the ground with us. And I'm not saying we didn't do some of those things, but he conveniently leaves out a lot of the stuff that happened with PMCs not being regulated, because his whole push is we were more efficient. You have to find that balance between regulation and efficiency, or you're going to have, I mean, essentially what we had in Iraq and Afghanistan for years and years and years, where the generals are hearing good news stories at all their briefings from all these, you know, colonels, and then what's really happening on the ground is like, you know, hey, we just had a guy that was wounded. We had a guy that died. Like, we don't want to be here. This doesn't make any sense. We haven't made any tangible progress on the ground. So there's no way to actually fix it is the problem. Unless you have the general that goes down there and hangs out in a Humvee for 3 weeks, and it's got to be 3 weeks. Generals go down all the time and they say, oh, I want to go on a combat operation. And they say, perfect. And they drive them out the front gate and they go to this little, you know, place where they sell rugs. They say, look at how safe it is. Well, for 3 weeks before that, they literally cleared everything out to make sure it was ultra safe. Generals, CEOs, they will never see the ground perspective because they have too many rungs of stupidity between them and the people on the ground that are actually doing it. They'll make sure they don't see it.
I think that will ring true for everybody watching and listening. And I think it's very well articulated. It reminds me of the publication on, I think it was New Year's Day this year, of in the States, the Declaration of Military Accountability. Is that something you're aware of? Written by, I think, about 250 serving and ex-serving members of the armed forces, essentially wanting to hold leadership to account. One of their strong themes was the way that service personnel were treated over COVID vaccine mandates and effectively a sort of dereliction of duty and the lack of welfare. I mean, whether or not that's something you are aware of, do you think that there's any way in which ground can be made to sort of counter some of the negligence of the leadership of the armed forces?
Not until somebody puts their rank on the table and says, I'm leaving if you keep doing this. In Afghanistan, nobody would say that exit was good. That it was, I mean, there are people that try to spin it, but nobody can look at that and say that was a positive. There was also no general, there was no Joint Chiefs of Staff member that put their rank on the table and said, this is such a bad idea, I don't want to be a part of it. Slide that over to the president. What happens is once you get to that 06, that colonel level and higher, you become more of a politician than you become an actual ground leader. So all these people are looking at their careers. They're looking at, I don't want to give anybody bad news. That's part of that middle management that makes it to where people don't understand what's happening on the ground. Somebody needs to stand up and say, I won't do this anymore. And get a big enough microphone to say, this is why this is a bad idea before anything will ever change. And I just don't think the military has become such a political apparatus in the United States that I don't think that there's anybody that's willing to do that.
I think you'd be absolutely right, or at least certainly it looks that way. Just to change tack slightly and to go back a bit, because you did allude to it somewhat in the way that PMCs are continuing to be used all over the world and that. Just to look at others, and I mean, you talked about Ukraine. What's your take on the Wagner Group and the way that that's been sort of reported and the actions of it and those around it?
So the Wagner Group is really kind of unique in that it is actually almost a branch of the military. Now, it is a rogue branch. It is the branch that can go out and do their own stuff. Most PMCs do not have like the war materiel to be able to do their own operations, right? It was us, it was three Suburbans and rifles and pistols, and that was about it. The Wagner Group, I mean, they have tanks, they have artillery, they are a full-scale unit that can go and they can take ground and they can hold ground. So it is, I mean, from a Russian perspective, it's a spectacular strategy. Because you can distance yourself from it and say, oh, that was the Wagner Group and they have, you know, this leader and he went rogue. And on the other hand is you can say, hey, guys, you know, super secret, like go over there and take that village. Go do whatever you need to do to get us this strategic standpoint so that I can then go in there with my military forces that are more regulated and be able to say, yes, we got that. So Wagner's definitely, I think it's in a category of its own. But I also think that if you continue down the PMC route and you continue to allow them to get these military vehicles, these MRAPs, these Mambas, the ones that are literally used in combat operations across the world, that I wouldn't be shocked if you started seeing some of that. We could get we could get anti-tank or law rockets, light anti-tank weapons. We could get 240 Bravos, 50 cals. We could get anything we wanted because we had booze. So it's pretty easy to go over there and say, hey, if you guys lose a 50 cal, here's a bottle of Jack Daniels. So it was happening kind of regardless, but we were never going to be offensive in the way that the Wagner Group was offensive.
Yeah, well, thank you for that. That's a really good sort of comparison. And, you know, leads one on to clearly the, what drives all of it, which is money, the sort of endless supply of money for all of this. Just can you paint a picture of the how it works or how it did work when you were with Blackwater and whether anything's changed over the course of time, I suppose specifically between the United States administration and any private military contractor that it uses. How does that system work?
It is like a 3 to 4 arm's length process. And I call it the single serve Starbucks coffee cup of combat operations. And I'll explain why. So what happens is, the Department of State goes and they contract and say, we need 1,000 people. Blackwater gets that contract. Blackwater then subcontracts out to other companies. So it could have been Triple Canopy. It could have been Aegis, right, which was the big British PMC one. And each one of them fill a little part of that. And then underneath that, you have me, which is the private military contractor. So I am a independent contractor. So if anything happens, if I do anything stupid, it's Morgan, and then it's Blackwater, and then it's the State Department, and then you could go all the way up the chain, right? But it allows every single part of them to say, it wasn't me, it was that guy. It's like the Spider-Man meme where everybody's pointing at each other, except there's one guy in the middle and it's me. So that's why I say it's like a single-use Starbucks coffee cup is they will use you until they don't need you anymore. So you go, you grab your Starbucks, you drink it, you leave like a third of it in there because it's cold and gross. So you guys drink more tea over there, not judging, it's not a big deal. But when you're done with that coffee cup, whether there's coffee left in it or not, you just throw it away. And that's kind of what the State Department did. If we don't need you, we're going to cut you. If we don't like, we had guys getting fired for the dumbest stuff. We had a guy that got fired because he didn't want to walk all the way to the bathroom and he peed on a fence. And the State Department guy saw him peeing on a fence and was like, fire that guy. So it really allows them to flex personnel into a needed area and then do whatever they want with that individual because there's no retribution. If you fire somebody that works for the State Department, it could take you 4, 5, 6 months to go through that process. Or you can see that guy peeing on a fence and say, get him out of here, and he's gone.
I like the analogy. The cup of coffee, it works very well. Now, just going back to a quote from the book, which I think will, really what does thought provoking. Between the Air Force, Blackwater, and the Army, I saw the evolution of war from the ground offensive to the peak of the fighting to the drawdown. I can't tell if we lost, but I know we didn't win. Now, in 2011, Julian Assange is regularly quoted saying of Afghanistan that the goal is an endless war and not a successful war. In light of what you've just been describing, how do you see that statement and, in effect, the future of the sort of the military-industrial complex and what you've just been describing?
Yeah, I think Julian Assange is giving a little bit more credit to the people than they deserve, because I don't think there's any intent at all. I think what happens is, and it's human nature, you go and you make a bad investment. You bought Bitcoin and Bitcoin plummets. What do? You hang on to that Bitcoin. Usually you'll kind of invest more and say, oh, I hope it gets better. And that was the succession of events in Iraq and Afghanistan. We went over there. The initial goal of combat operations was done. And then it says, oh, we're not really doing what we thought we would. Let's throw more money at it, throw more people at it. Let's keep going because we're on the right path. And it becomes this morality issue where US politicians want to say, we did this, it was the right thing to do. We're going to stick with it for as long as we possibly have to in order for it to go. Until finally somebody comes in and says, no, you got to cut your losses. So Julian Assange is right in that there was no winning or losing of those wars. But I don't think that there was enough forethought of anybody except, oh, if we just do more, if we just keep throwing more money at it, more people and more you know, deaths and more, it's going to work out. And it was never going to.
And what about the media in all of this? What part, I mean, you were just talking about how, in effect, in terms of media coverage, how insignificant the deaths of anybody working for a PMC can be, or at least can be treated by the media. How do you see the role of media in the conduct of, operations overseas?
Well, the media is only going to be as good as the information that they get, right? Garbage in, garbage out data. So they're getting a lot of their information from those politicians, from those generals, from those people that actually aren't on the ground doing stuff. So they reported what they thought was accurate until it becomes the same talking point over and over again, and somebody's got to find a new angle for it. That's when I think you started seeing in 05, 06, where the war stuff started getting some like negative connotations associated with it. I think the media needs to dig below that initial talking point that you see and say, what is going on with PMCs? I can't fathom that these things aren't being reported on a daily basis. Hey, we're not putting boots on the ground, but we're still putting American citizens over there that are dying, and we're having to bring them home in body bags. Like, there's still U.S. citizens that are dying overseas for these different wars. And it feels like the journalists are just kind of putting blinders on right now, because if it's not sensational, if it's not something that you can report on in 24 hours to 48 hours, it's not worth putting the time and effort into identify why are these contracts still happening? How much money is going to PMCs? Where is that money going? Like, the fact that you have a private military company on the U.S.-Mexico border that is taking unaccompanied minors into the United States with very little, if any, documentation of who they're dropping them off with. Are they related? Like, I would be shocked if these kids had any kind of birth certificate showing who they were. And then what happens when one of these kids ends up dying or something bad happens? What's going to happen? Who actually looked into that? And I'll tell you, it's not going to be the government agency. It's got to be a journalist at this point that can literally dig down and say, this kid went from point A to point B, and then this is what happened. And whether it's good or it's bad, somebody needs to understand that we are outsourcing morality at this point. We are outsourcing combat operations. We are outsourcing moving children. We are outsourcing training other individuals. We're outsourcing police operations. These are very morally poignant jobs that we are just giving to people and saying, hey, you got 2 weeks of training, come on in. That makes no sense to me. Don't get me wrong, I made a lot of money on it. I was very happy back then. But now that I'm older and I have kids, it seems ridiculous.
Outsourcing morality, I think, is an excellent umbrella term for all that you do describe. And in fact, specifically on the border issue, that is something that UK Column does cover via our US correspondent. So that will definitely inform part of the future news cycle. And what you've just said, I mean, what I would like to, sort of move towards or to wind up with really is, just tell me about writing the book. You know, you've spoken a lot about the lack of care or support that people who've chosen your path have received. Obviously, you've been on both sides of the fence. But just describe the motivation for writing the book and the actual process by which you got through it. Because I would imagine, looking at a lot of the subject matter, it must have been either cathartic or traumatic to write, or perhaps both at the same time?
It was both. I think there was two reasons to write the book. One was, history is always done via a pen, not by a sword, right? So when we look back at Iraq and Afghanistan and the roles that PMCs have done, there are books out there. They are written by Eric Prince. They're written by people that hate Eric Prince. There needed to be a book written by the people that actually did the job. Nobody else was doing it, so hey, why the heck not me? Second was, every time I would tell a story about Blackwater, and if you don't laugh when you read this book, like there's, you may need to go see a therapist. I mean, it was funny. And that's what you do in combat, right? There are horrible things happening, and you just put humor on top of it to cope with it. So after enough people finally told me, hey, these stories are hilarious and they're crazy, I can't believe it actually happened, I just started putting pen to paper to do it. I was hoping it was going to be cathartic. I was hoping that I was going to be able to come to grips, you know, with my mommy and daddy issues through Blackwater, Eric Prince is my father. I don't know what I was trying to get out of it. But it ended up bringing up a bunch of crap that I had buried down into my little jar that I didn't really want to open, right? You know, somewhere, my emotional jar. I don't know. I'm going to have to come up with a cool term. But that's why with the book, I try to give you what it was like, the good, the bad, the emotional, the anger, the frustration, like the tears, everything in the book, because these are real people that are doing this stuff. When you read a book about, you know, a politician writes a book. I read Robert Gates's book, and he was like, this soldier was missing his hand, and I went out to reach over and shake his hand. And I was like, where's the emotion in that? Like, yes, he's losing a hand, but where's the emotion of being able to say, I felt like an idiot because I reached out my right hand when he was missing his, and I thought about that for the next 4 hours. They don't put that stuff in the books because they don't want to show the actual moral and emotional toll that war takes on people. So it was good and it was bad. You know, I got a little catharsis out of it. And then my wife read it and was like, oh my God, who'd I marry? So, you know, 50-50.
Well, for what it's worth, I think it is terrifically written. It is exactly as you described. I mean, it's nonstop. It's absolute wall-to-wall sort of action, but the dialogue is fantastic. And it's very poignant, very thoughtful. I really would commend people to read it. But tell me now, because you've been through all of this, you've had many, I don't know if demons is quite the right word, but you found yourself in some places that have been mentally challenging to deal with, but you've obviously got on top of that. You describe yourself, I think, and I hope I'm current, as being sort of in corporate America now. How is that? How is life after all of these experiences?
I mean, life is easy. And it's not that life is easy. It's that I've had people reach out to me on a number of occasions at work and say, why aren't you stressing out? Why aren't you freaking out? And it was like, because like, this is not that big of a deal. We'll get it figured out. Like, I can't control all this stuff. So why not just let it kind of go through its paces? As an intel officer, it was always the first intelligence report you get is always wrong. Wait for the second, because the second is either going to confirm it or you're going to get new intel that's wrong. So wait for the third. Same thing in corporate America. It's like, just, it's not that big of a deal. It's not going to change our profit and loss statement. You know, I'm not that high up. I'm not cool enough. I'm not the CEO. But I mean, corporate America is kind of a hoot because at the same time, when you really want to get something done and that's how you're trained, you have to take that step back and say, all right, these aren't, you know, my teammates over at Blackwater or my military soldiers or anything else. Like, you just have to let the process play out. And I think that's a lot of soldiers get into the corporate America landscape and they think, wow, is this it? Yeah, that's it. You know what? Like, you had cool experiences, you have cool stories, write them down, but, you know, make your money as much as you can and enjoy your life now. You've already done your cool stuff. Just soak it in.
So that leads me into, I think, what will probably be a question to wrap it up with, which is, you did say very briefly your sort of opinion on this, but if you were to talk to school leavers now, or indeed your own children when the time is right, what would you say to them about the possibility of joining any of the armed forces or looking at the world of private military contracting or anything within that orbit?
I mean, if my kids wanted to join the military, they absolutely could. And I would not actively encourage them, but I think that after years of war, I'm a little bit tainted because I don't see the paradigm changing where war is going to actually have a start and an end date. And if that's the case, then we're just throwing young people into, you know, the wood chipper, hoping that it gets better. So I would let my kids know, join the military, get as much out of it as it gets out of you, and then move on from it. Like, I would tell nobody to go into PMCs because the legal liability that you have if something happens to that kid or over in Syria or the Ukraine, you have no legal repercussions, but the US government has a lot of your money that it will spend going after you for as long as it needs to. And they've shown that. So if you're going to go into the PMC world, get a liability insurance coverage for about $8 billion and then go and see if the return on investment actually comes back, because it is not a place where they won't throw you to the wolves like the moment that something bad happens.
I think that's a very poignant note upon which to end. So what I will remind you of is that notes and links for this interview will be posted below this at ukcolumn.org. If you are in a position to support UK Column financially so that we can continue to produce excellent interviews with guests such as Morgan Lorette, then please do so. And again, you can find details for that at ukcolumn.org. So it just remains for me to thank very much Morgan Lorette for joining me for a UK Column interview. Morgan, it's been absolutely fantastic. I think your insights will absolutely electrify the audience. And also, before you go, what I would like you to do, please, is just tell the audience where we can find your material, any social media presence, but also where do we go to buy or view your book, Guns, Girls, and Greed?
Yeah, so it's available on audio and Kindle and everything on Amazon. So if you're like me and you actually want the hardcover, you can grab it there. You can track me down on X, on Instagram, if it ever comes back online. At Blackwater Dude One, really cool name. I don't know if I can back that up, but happy to talk to anybody out there. Thank you so much for having me on. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Not at all. Thank you very much indeed.